I'm Alan Garley. I'm a urogynecologist at the Mount Sinai Health Network in New York. Today we're going to be talking about pregnant patient and abdominal emergencies. I find this is a really interesting topic every year if we can do sort of different iterations on it, because surgeons in general get a little confused sometimes when they have to deal with the patient when they're pregnant. It adds a little different level of complexity. And so it's nice to get a review. Today we put together a panel of trauma surgeon, general surgeon, high-risk obstetrician, and radiology to see if we can all come together and come up with really good cohesive plans on how to take care of these patients. Our speakers today are Dr. Errol Norwitz. Dr. Norwitz is the chairman of OBGYN at Tufts Medical Center and the chief scientific officer for that system as well. We also have William Cherish, who is the chief of trauma surgery at University of Vermont. We have Jennifer Uyeda, who is the assistant director of emergency radiology at the Brigham, and Dr. Edward Barrazzo, who is the chief of general surgery also at the University of Vermont. Our first lecture today will be with Dr. Norwitz.
Okay. Good morning, everyone. I feel like I'm at the UN with all the flags behind me, the big hall. But I did find the South African flag, which is where I grew up in Cape Town, South Africa. So I was pleased to see that. So I think I have to get my slides on. All right. Okay, so my name's Errol Norwitz. Is that showing? It's not coming up on the screen. Oh, there we go. Okay. We'll see if this is working. Yes. So my name's Errol Norwitz. I'm chair of OBGYN at Tufts Medical Center here in Boston. My background is as a maternal fetal medicine trained physician, that's a high-risk obstetrician, and we're going to talk today about obstetric concerns in the pregnant patient with an abdominal emergency. I have no disclosures, and what we're going to do over the next 20 minutes is to talk a little bit about the risks of abdominal emergencies in pregnant patients, both to the mother and to the fetus, how to recognize the physiologic changes that occur in pregnancy and how this affects your diagnosis and management of abdominal emergencies, and ultimately to come up with a clear and rational approach for the management of these patients. And we'll talk about non-obstetric emergencies, and then we'll walk through obstetric emergencies in the first, second, and third trimesters. The first point to make is that pregnancy puts an enormous stress on the mother. The mother's system is designed, if you like, in broad terms, to support the fetus in terms of volume, nutrition and oxygen supply, clearance of waste, to protect the fetus from drugs, starvation, and toxins, to prepare the uterus for labor, and ultimately to prevent the woman from exsanguinating at delivery. And in order to do so, there are physiologic adaptations that occur in every single organ system of the mother, the cardiovascular, hematologic, immunologic, even the musculoskeletal, GI, and eye and skin. And I don't want to take up a lot of time talking about these physiologic changes, but in terms of surgery, I thought I'd go through one or two organ systems that are affected most critically. So here we have the blood pressure changes. This is mean arterial pressure change over pregnancy. Remember, the pulse pressure increases, but mean arterial pressure drops in the first trimester, nadirs in the second trimester, primarily because of the influence of progesterone. So progesterone levels go up very dramatically after conception. They're 50 to 100 times higher than in non-pregnant women, and actually one of the highest levels in all animal species. And they are peripheral vasodilators. So they dilate the vasculature, and as a result, you get a drop in the mean arterial pressure. This results in activation of the renin-angiotensin system. You get sodium retention from the renal tubules, and water follows. So the circulating blood volume starts to pick up in the second and third part of pregnancy, and you get increasing blood volume, about 700 cc's to 800 cc's in a singleton pregnancy, up to 1.5 liters of circulating volume increase in twin pregnancies. You get a dilutional anemia, in turn, EPO is released by the kidneys, and you get action or activation of the bone marrow, leading to an increase in circulating red blood cell mass. So that lags about 6 to 8 weeks, but your red blood cell mass starts to go up as well, so that at delivery, you are ready to lose about 500 cc's of blood. That's the normal blood loss after vaginal delivery, about 1,000 cc's at cesarean. And after that, the blood volume returns to normal and you have your normal hematocrit. And that's the normal physiologic adaptation. These are healthy women, no complications. The other system I just wanted to mention briefly was the respiratory system. And you can see the effects here shown graphically on the respiratory system. So at the end of pregnancy, we know the increasing, the fundal height, the uterus increases, it impinges on the diaphragm, prevents women from taking deep breaths, if you like. So women breathe a lot more with their intercostal muscles than their diaphragm. And as a result, the residual capacity goes down. But look at the first part of pregnancy. You can see there's a dramatic change in the first part of pregnancy as well, even before the uterus reaches 12 weeks and starts to emerge from the pelvis. And that's again through the influence of progesterone. So progesterone is a respiratory stimulant. It triggers women to breathe a little bit more fast, but actually much deeper as well. So they take a few more breaths per minute, but also the breaths are much deeper. And so the minute ventilation increases. And this is really important for anybody who's been a diver, any scuba divers out there, you know that if you sit at the surface and hyperventilate, what happens? You blow down your CO2 because CO2 crosses membranes 22 times faster than oxygen. So you blow down your CO2 and then you can dive down and stay underwater a lot longer. It's great. I grew up in Cape Town. We did a lot of diving and spearfishing, and it was a great way to stay underwater for longer. The only problem is it can be quite dangerous. Right, because the trigger for respiration is the CO2 level, not low O2, but high CO2 level. So if you blow down your CO2 and then you dive down, it turns out that the oxygen levels can drop dangerously low and you can pass out before CO2 gets to a point where it actually triggers respiration at once and the urge to breathe. So this, a very similar thing happens in the fetus. The women are breathing much faster, they're blowing off CO2, and as a result, pregnancy represents a state of fully compensated respiratory alkalosis. The pH is unchanged as compared with non-pregnant women. The PO2 goes up a little bit because they are breathing a little faster and a little deeper, but very importantly, their PCO2 is blown down to 27 to 32 millimeters of mercury. So if you have a patient who's complaining of shortness of breath, you do an arterial blood gas, and their PCO2 is 35, that is not normal in pregnancy. That patient's in impending respiratory failure may need to be intubated and taken to the ICU. So these are important changes for you to know when you're managing these patients in a surgical setting. What does that mean? If you look at the acid-base status in pregnancy, on the left-hand side, you'll see the mother. This is exactly what I described, pH 7.40, PCO2 27 to 32, PO2 just over 100. The blood then passes to the placenta. The placenta is an incredibly active metabolic organ. It takes off about 60% of all the oxygen. So just going through the placenta, the PO2 comes down to about 30, PCO2 rises to about 40. And then it goes to the fetus and then comes back through the two umbilical arteries. And at that point, the pH has dropped down to 7.28, the PO2 down to about 20, and the PCO2 has risen to 50. So these are the normal changes that occur in an otherwise healthy pregnancy. What does this mean for the fetus? The fetus is actually living at a PO2 the same as the top of Everest, right? The environment is not exactly the same. I think the PCO2 is about 1, so it's not the identical environment. But each one of us, when we were a fetus for the first 9 months of life, lived in an environment that was hypoxic and equivalent to the top of Everest. How did we do it? Fetal hemoglobin, right? The fetus has a different hemoglobin, hemoglobin F, much more efficient at pulling oxygen off adult hemoglobin. So that's how we, each one of us, survived as a fetus before we entered the world. So this is important to understand as we go on to talk a little bit about surgical conditions in pregnancy. So in pregnancy, again, you're going to get a lecture by a surgeon who probably knows these instances a lot better than I do, but remember that any condition that occurs in non-pregnant women can also occur during pregnancy, and common conditions occur commonly. Things like appendicitis, cholecystitis, as common, sometimes more common in pregnant than non-pregnant women. And I would argue, and this is going to be a theme, I think, of the whole panel discussion, that many more women are harmed through delayed diagnosis, delayed treatment, than are ever harmed through interventions that we do. So make sure that you can identify these patients and manage them appropriately, in many cases as you would with a non-pregnant patient. Specific conditions in pregnancy as regards to non-obstetric causes. Appendicitis, remember, is not more common in pregnancy, but actually is more likely to rupture. And again, this may be delayed diagnosis. It may be some of the changes that occur in the appendix. It's not clear. The appendix is also displaced a little bit, so be aware it can be atypical in its presentation. Gallstones, much more common in pregnancy, as well as all of the complications of gallstone disease. For whatever reason, splenic artery rupture is more common. So if you have intra-abdominal bleeding, that's something just to think about. And do be careful of patients with prior bariatric surgery. I've seen several cases now where they've herniated the bowel through the anastomosis, ended up necrotic. And again, people are reluctant to take these patients to the OR. They're 32 weeks pregnant. You know, they've had extensive bariatric surgery. And within a day, the baby's dead and they're dead. So that is one condition just to be aware of. What I thought I'd do is very quickly walk you through the three trimesters of pregnancy and talk a little bit about some of the unique conditions that occur during pregnancy. The first is ectopic pregnancy. So this is ectopic pregnancy refers to any pregnancy that's outside of the uterine cavity. Most often it's in the tube, but it can be in the ovary. It can be up in the liver. I've seen several of those cases. Extrauterine intra-abdominal ectopic pregnancies, which are very cool. They go all the way to term. You can see them at 40 weeks. Do they go into labor? Yes, they do. Very interesting. We don't know how and why, but they do. Obviously, they can't deliver because the baby's outside of the uterine cavity, but it's a very interesting case. But ectopic pregnancy, especially tubal pregnancy, still kills women in this day and age. So do check your beta HCG levels. Be aware what they should be, and be aware on ultrasound when you should identify an intrauterine pregnancy. Remember, the goal of ultrasound early on in pregnancy is to confirm an intrauterine pregnancy. It's not to try and search the abdomen to try and find the ectopic trophoblast tissue, just to see whether or not there's an intrauterine pregnancy. Remember to give Rogam and get your OBGYN colleagues involved if there are any questions at all. Other things that can occur unique to the first trimester, torsion, miscarriage, ruptured cyst, and then this unusual condition called round ligament pain, which is really a diagnosis of exclusion. The uterus can sometimes get stuck in the pelvis, and it's retroverted and gets stuck in the sacral curve, and that has to be manually reduced. Very rare, but if you do see it, it's quite a dramatic presentation with pain and urinary retention. Just to let you know, pelvic inflammatory disease, in essence, does not occur in pregnancy. There's no ways for the organisms to get up into the uterus and into the tube if there's a pregnancy. I've seen it once in 25 years. So yes, sometimes we make the diagnosis, but it's extremely, extremely rare. In the second trimester, this is 14 to 28 weeks. This is generally a time of quiescence in pregnancy. Most things settle down. Patients get over their nausea and vomiting, and the fetus is continuing to grow and develop. Fibroids can present at this time, so if they start to degenerate, that can be very uncomfortable. We do give non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs to help them with the discomfort. Remember, that shouldn't be given more than 48 hours. It adversely affects blood through the ductus arteriosus, shunts it to the lungs, and causes pulmonary hypertension. So just less than 48 hours. And then anything we see in the third trimester can present early, things like preterm labor, uterine rupture, preeclampsia and HELLP syndrome. And I just want to go through some of those very quickly. So this is the third trimester of pregnancy after 28 weeks. And these are the kind of conditions that we see on a daily basis on labor and delivery in many instances in a big unit. Placental abruption, this is a decidual hemorrhage where the placenta separates from the uterine sidewall before delivery. It can present with vaginal bleeding in 80% of time, but 20% the bleeding can be contained behind the placenta. It's a difficult diagnosis to make, primarily a clinical diagnosis. Sometimes you get contractions in uterine tenderness. The most sensitive index is that the baby gets into trouble. Remember, the surface area of the placenta is about 10 square meters, which is enormous. It's the size of a tennis court. And you can lose up to half of that before you actually end up in fetal demise. So there's a lot of redundancy. But in a large abruption, non-reassuring testing, it can be very helpful, and you can do that by ultrasound or by looking at the fetal heart rate monitor. Again, I show here a CT scan. We don't usually do CT scans in these patients, but if you do, you can identify a large abruption. Remember, you need about 1 unit of blood, 300 cc's or more, to be able to visualize the blood clot behind the placenta using ultrasound. So not very sensitive in picking this up. I said consider CT scan. CT scan involves ionizing radiation. So we're going to get a whole talk about ionizing radiation in pregnancy. I just have one slide. There are only three adverse events that have really ever been described and associated directly with ionizing radiation: miscarriage, microcephaly and neurodevelopmental delay, and possibly myeloproliferative disorders in childhood. Those are the three findings that have been consistently shown in the literature. This is all indirect evidence. We don't put patients through investigational ionizing radiation experiments. So most of this is from indirect evidence from Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the experience there in terms of distance from the epicenter of these pregnant women and from animal models, mainly rabbit models. In essence, you probably need 10, probably more than 20 rads to injure a fetus, and most of the studies we do are well, well below that. ACOG has come out specifically and said less than 5 rads is completely safe. So again, I'm going to stop there. You're going to get a much more detailed discussion in the next lecture. Other things we look for, aside from abruption, uterine rupture. I thought you wouldn't mind some gory pictures since you're a surgical audience. But this can be catastrophic. It's usually in the site of a previous cesarean delivery scar, and it mostly occurs during labor. If you've had a high vertical incision, what we call a classical hysterotomy, 50% of those will rupture before labor, and that's very dangerous. The scar opens up, the fetus is in the abdomen, the mother loses a couple of liters of blood, and she has only a few minutes for you to resuscitate her. It can be very dramatic, and it's a major cause of mortality in pregnant women. It's very rare, fortunately, and it's a clinical diagnosis. Very rarely seen on imaging. I did pull up an image I found here of a uterine rupture after an abdominal trauma, an MVA, and you can see here, I don't know if this will show up well, but you can essentially see the uterus that's empty, labeled U, and then the fetus that lies outside of the uterus with lots of blood. So this is a very dramatic presentation. On ultrasound, sometimes we'll see a little hand sneaking through the uterus if you have a window or dehiscence in the scar, and that can be quite dramatic when you see it. Then you're wondering what to do. This is another instance that we watch out for, preeclampsia. In this case, specifically HELP syndrome. HELP is an acronym that stands for hemolysis, elevated liver enzymes, low platelets, and it's one of the clinical situations or one of the severe preeclampsia conditions. So preeclampsia is either non-severe or severe, what we used to call mild preeclampsia or severe preeclampsia, we now call non-severe and severe, with severe features and without severe features. Preeclampsia itself is a hypertensive disorder of pregnancy made after 20 weeks with evidence of other organ damage in the mother. Sometimes it's kidney damage and they leak protein. Sometimes it's damage to the liver or the brain or other organ systems. So it's a very dramatic presentation here. It is the second greatest cause of maternal mortality, and so we watch these patients very closely. It's said that a woman dies somewhere in the world every 8 minutes from complications of preeclampsia, and we haven't figured out how to properly diagnose it, let alone how to predict it or prevent it. So a very dangerous condition. But if you do have liver involvement, you can get a hematoma, and that can rupture. And this is a case I took care of when I was in South Africa, a very dramatic case where the mother did not ultimately survive. Urgent delivery is indicated in these cases. If you do have a hematoma, don't go pushing on it during surgery. Okay, I've had patients, they come in with right upper quadrant pain, they look like they have severe preeclampsia. We get an imaging study and we see a large liver hematoma stretching Glisson's capsule, causing pain, and the attending there calls all the medical students in and says, come and feel this, you're not going to feel this in a long time. You know, these are rare cases. And after a lot of medical students pushing on the abdomen, the hematoma ruptured. So not a good idea, leave it alone. And then do consider other differentials in this clinical setting, but this is the most dangerous condition you need to watch for. Preterm labor is another condition. Regular phasic uterine contractions, increasing in frequency and intensity with cervical change, occurs now in about 10% of all patients in the US, delivered prior to 37 weeks. And we don't know, have a very good way of treating it. Giving tocolytic agents does not work. It's the mainstay of our therapy, has been for 40 years. It doesn't work. At best, it can delay delivery for 24 to 48 hours to get the patient to a tertiary care center, to get antenatal corticosteroids on board, but it really doesn't delay preterm birth. If you are going to manage these patients and take them to the OR, remember, stabilize the mother first and resuscitate the fetus in utero before considering delivery. And if in doubt, get your OBGYNs involved. I just wanted to show one or two slides about trauma in pregnancy. This is something you'll probably encounter in an emergency setting. About one in 12 pregnancies will have some kind of trauma, some of which is mild, some of which is much more dramatic, and it's the leading cause of non-obstetric maternal deaths in the US. It also affects the fetus, one of the leading causes of perinatal morbidity and mortality. And it depends on the severity of the trauma. If somebody slips downstairs and lands on their bottom, that's not as dangerous. If they land directly on the abdomen, that's a little bit more dangerous. And then if they're in a high-speed MVA and get hit against their belly against the steering wheel, that's obviously much more dramatic. A Kleihau-Becky test is an acid elution test. We take a sample of the mother's blood, do a test in the lab where we add an acid and it creates ghost cells for the mothers, and you can see if there are any fetal cells circulating in the mother's blood because they're much more resistant to acid elution. And we can calculate or estimate what the fetal maternal hemorrhage has been. So if you've had an MVA, you'll send off the test. If it's less than 5 cc's, that shows some of the fetal blood got into the mother, but only a small amount. If it's greater than 30, we get very concerned. Remember, the fetus only has 120 to 130 cc's per kilo of blood. So in a term fetus, 3.5 kilograms, that's only 400 cc's of blood in the entire fetus and the placenta. These fetuses can exsanguinate really, really quickly, even at term. So motor vehicle accidents is most concerning. There is a special way all women should be wearing seatbelts in pregnancy when they're in the car, and there's a special way to place it over the top of the abdomen and below the belly. Don't put it over the belly. That'll just create more problems. Intimate partner violence, what we used to call domestic violence, just be aware that's much more common in pregnancy. It's counterintuitive. You think that there'd be less domestic violence. It turns out it actually goes up in pregnancy, and it's very common. So if you see a patient with abdominal trauma, do ask about safety in the home. If you are going to take these patients to the operating room in the latter half of pregnancy, make sure you have an entire team ready to go. So make sure your OBGYN's aware. The NICU team needs to be aware. We've had cases where we've done abdominal surgery for gallbladder disease, and on the table they go into labor and deliver, and that can be quite embarrassing. You hear a little cry between the legs. You want to make sure your NICU team's there with the resuscitation equipment that they need to take care of these patients. Decide on your surgical approach. Is it going to be laparoscopy or laparotomy? Laparoscopy can be done quite safely, even in the third trimester. There are special considerations that are going to be discussed further on. And then think about the mother. Give supplemental oxygen. That increases the amount of oxygen dissolved in the blood, not necessarily the oxygen saturation, but the amount of dissolved oxygen. What does it do to fetal oxygenation? Absolutely nothing. Okay, we all resuscitate the fetus, give the mother oxygen. Turns out it doesn't actually affect the fetal oxygenation at all, but we still do it. It's part of our algorithm. Make sure you have large bore IVs, labs, bloods. Remember that these are young, healthy women in general, and they can lose up to 20% or 40% of their blood loss, 2 liters, before they actually drop their blood pressure. So watch for tachycardia. It's a very sensitive index that the patient's becoming unstable, but they can lose a lot of blood into their belly or elsewhere before they actually drop their blood pressures. They are at risk of aspiration, so drop an NG tube, rapid sequence induction, get your anesthesiologist on board, and put them in left lateral tilt, because after 20 weeks, the uterus falls back onto the IVC and impedes venous return. About the fetus, document fetal well-being before you go into the operating room, very important, and afterwards. ACOG says that if the fetus is viable, which we regard as above 23 to 24 weeks, you should consider monitoring fetal well-being throughout, routinely throughout the surgery, and we can talk about that a little bit in the question and answers if you want. There are things we can do to help the fetus if it's delivered early. Give antenatal steroids, it takes 2 days. We can give intravenous magnesium sulfate for 12 hours, it's neuroprotective. And avoid agents that may be teratogenic. Remember, if the mother codes and needs resuscitation, the fact that the uterus is full, in this case full of a fetus, really does affect the ability for you to resuscitate the fetus. So this is some of the data around maternal cardiac arrest and how long you have to resuscitate the mother and the fetus. If it lasts longer than 5 minutes, then the fetal survival goes down quite dramatically. So our standard recommendation is, if you haven't been able to resuscitate the mother after cardiopulmonary arrest for 4 to 5 minutes, you should empty the uterus. What does that mean? A large vertical incision, open up the uterus vertically, get the the fetus out, close the uterus in a single layer, and then leave the abdomen open with some film covering it. Because if the uterus fills up with blood and it's now 30 weeks size, you have the same problem as you did when the fetus is inside. And so you do want to enter the uterus to help resuscitate the mother. So in conclusion then, you should approach abdominal emergency in pregnancy just like you do for non-pregnant patients. Again, I would argue that many more women are damaged by delayed diagnosis, delay in treatment, as compared with any intervention that we will ever do. Be aware of the physiologic changes as you manage these patients. It's really important to know what normal levels are in pregnancy. When you get your printout of blood value results and you get a normative range, okay, that's normal usually for old men, right? It's not normal for women. It's not normal for pregnancy. So be aware how those normative values change. And then be aware of your differential diagnosis. And do get an entire team involved in these cases. You want the NICU to be there, the OBGYNs, trauma surgeon if you need. Anesthesia needs to be on board because there are specific anesthetic considerations that need to be taken into account. So kind of a whirlwind tour about abdominal emergencies in pregnancy. And I'll stop there. And I think we're going to take questions afterwards during the panel discussion. Thank you.